So I'm going to start with an apology, because I said last time that we were going to do the history of Purim, and I spent a week trying to understand the history, and I can't get my head around it. That's the truth of the matter.
Wow,
I realize it is way more difficult than I can do in 1 week, and so now I've got a year till next Purim trying to do it. Why is it difficult? I'll just, some of the, but without even looking at non-Jewish sources, which makes it a whole lot more complicated, just looking at the Jewish sources is very complicated, because nobody is who they really are. Everybody's using pseudonyms, and it's not clear which pseudonym is which. And, I mean, in the Megillah, this is very simply, in the Megillah, Esther's not her real name.
Right.
Right, her real name is Hadassah. It says that in the Megillah. Mordechai is not his real name.
Marduk
is the name of a Babylonian god.
Okay.
A Sumerian Babylonian god, as is Ishtar. Also, both of them are named after gods. Also, Mordechai is named after Evel Merodach, who was the king of Babylon after Nebuchadnezzar. So that's not his real name. His real name, according to the Mishnah in Menachos, is Petachia. And there's a whole discussion in the Gemara there about why he's called Petachia. But Mordechai is not his Jewish name. Achashverosh is not his real name either. You think if you're going to make up a name, you could have done better than that. But it's not clear, at any rate, whether Achashverosh is in fact Achashverosh, or is really Achashashta. Not at all clear who he is. Not clear which Achashverosh he is, because there may have been two of them. Not clear if he's the son of Dariavish or the father of Dariavish, or whether Dariavish and Koresh are the same person or different people, and maybe Achashashta is the same person as well. Yeah. Haman is Haman.
There we go. At least we get something right.
As far as I can tell, it should be very simple to work out who Achashverosh is, for example, because Ezra is quite explicit in Ezra chapter 4. It says, if I can find the right verse. If I can find chapter 4. What's happening over here? Wait, it goes from verse 12 to verse 7. That doesn't make sense.
It goes from what? From 12 to 7. Do you want to...
Oh, no, there it is. It's too calm. Sorry, I can do this. It's not really too hard for me. It's just my brain's a bit fried from trying to understand the history. Yeah, so it says in chapter 4, verse 5 and 6, actually even before, it talks about they want to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And they can't rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. V'yomer lehem Zerubbabel, v'yeshua, v'shar, v'shay ha'avad, v'yishrael, lo lachem l'lam, l'vno beid alakenu, v'yaki anachnu yachan imnei al Hashem, l'akein Yisrael, k'ashe tivan ha'merach Koresh, melach Parat. So Koresh told us to go and build the Beit HaMikdash, and we'll go and do that. Great. Right, and the people there were hassling them and stopping them from building. And they hired advisors to try and undo the building of the Beit HaMikdash. All the days of Koresh and through the days of Dariavish and Darius. Of Malchut Achashverosh. In the time of Achashverosh, they wrote a letter about Yerushalayim, Yehuda and Yerushalayim, to stop them building the Beit HaMikdash, and it will be May Atachshashta, Kadav Bishlam Mitarda, etc., etc. So it seems clear there was Koresh, then Dariavish, Cyrus, and then Darius, and then Achashverosh, and then Atachshashta. But first of all, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says that Koresh and Dariavish and Artaxerxes were all the same person, which doesn't seem to fit with the words. We know that Cyrus lived after Achashverosh in the Purim story, not before. And according to Rashi in the beginning of the Megillah, in the beginning of Esther, Rashi tries to work out which Achashverosh it is. Where did they put Esther in this book? Not where she's supposed to be. Where did I hide Esther? Anyway, so really weird. The Megillah's all missing. Maybe it's... With Rashi? Chumash Rashi should have that. Anyway, Rashi says that Ahasuerus is the son of Dariavish. It doesn't matter. It's fine. No, it doesn't matter. Rashi tries to work out who it is, and the Sifrei Chachamim there try to say who it's not. But it's just like the most basic information. We really don't know. And there's a machlokes between Rashi, between the Meforashim on the page, and between the Targum Sheni, which is earlier than the Rishonim, who seems to say that Cyrus was Ahasuerus' father, and Rashi was Dariavish. There's a person called Dariavish Hamadzai, Darius the Mede, who is clearly part of the Jewish tradition, but doesn't appear in any non-Jewish records of the time at all. So there's like two, whatever. Anyway, basically, I just gave up. I tried very hard, and I couldn't get any of it straight in my head. I gave up, so I apologize. I also. Yes.
How important.
So that's what the other thing I was going to say was Micha Berger. I was emailing him, and he said that a shiur should be about something meaningful and not necessarily just about history, which is interesting, but doesn't teach you anything. So, So I take your point.
Definitely, if you
want to
go to the next
one. Yeah, indeed. I think the answer to that question is I think it's important because. I'm sure there are people who know it. I just haven't found them yet.
No, there's probably five people who answered
this. Yes, that's probably true.
Like there's no one answer
to any of it. Next time you see your rabbi, whoever you speak to, just ask him if he can list the order of the kings, please, from Nebuchadnezzar to Koresh. Well, I tried that with my rabbi, and he said, hang on a second, look in a book. Oh, no, I don't know. Just forget any of the difficult, just a very simple...
Sometimes Google
brings. Yeah, no, Google doesn't know this one either. And Belshazzar... Belshazzar is the son of Nebuchadnezzar, but so is Evel Merodach, who's called Emel Merodach. In other versions, I need to figure it out. I really want to. I'll tell you why it's important to figure it out, because I think, just like all the names aren't who they are, I think the theme of the Megillah is completely not stated in the Megillah. The words that don't appear, everyone knows that God's name does not appear in Megillah Esther.
Mm.
Fine. Neither does Yerushalayim appear in Megillah Esther. They're in exile, trying to get back to Jerusalem. The word Yerushalayim does not appear. The word Beit HaMikdash does not appear. The word Yisrael does not appear. Neither referring to the, as far as, I mean, I may have missed one, but doesn't it not apply to the country Israel, nor applying to the people, B'nai Yisrael. They're always called Yehudim. For the first time in this book, the Jews are called Yehudim instead of B'nai Yisrael. Torah Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't appear anywhere in the Megillah. All of those things are the central themes. This is a book written in exile about the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash in Jerusalem, which has been temporarily suspended by Haman and his children. And it's about giving the Jews back to Israel, which is Ad-Chatziyah Malchus, and it's about Jewish identity, and all of the things are there, and not a single one of them is mentioned in the Megillah. So the whole Megillah is about what it's not.
Right.
Like exoplanets, if I can quote it out. Right, exoplanets. We infer exoplanets are there by the motion of the star around which it's... We don't actually see exoplanets directly. We infer that it's there because the sun, that it's orbiting wobbles. We can tell what the theme of the Megillah is about by seeing all the wobbles in the Megillah and everything that's not really there. Right? And all the words that are missing are what the main theme, and therefore it's important to understand the history of the time, to understand who's building what and when they're going back to and what they're stopping, what Haman's real idea is, and what happened between the first Beit HaMikdash and the second Beit HaMikdash that allowed for the B'nai Yisrael to become Yehudim. So I think it really is... I'm not sure if there's a Muslim message in it necessarily, but I think to actually understand the Megillah is really important to get a shut level of Megillah, and that I still had to give up and couldn't do it. So instead I'm going to tell you something from Rav Tzadok HaKohen, which is also really neat, but you may have heard this kind of idea before, but I think Rav Tzadok still has a few unique twists in his inimitable way. And you'll notice the source sheet is different than usual. Whatever. So Shabbat. We know Shabbat has Kedusha because God sanctified Shabbat from the time of creation. Right? And whether there are Jews in the world or no Jews in the world, Shabbat has a certain holiness because God imbued it with holiness. I think there's, I think Chai Adam writes that when he goes to the mikveh on Friday afternoon, he can feel the, he can sense the Kedusha of Shabbat. I think it's a Chai Adam, and I think it's something like that. And I'd be interested to know what would happen if Chai Adam went to Samoa today to see, because they just changed the other side of the deadline a month or so ago.
Oh, yeah.
And they turned their Saturday into Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
So when is Shabbat in Samoa, Western Samoa, as opposed to American Samoa?
Like where the two kind of
so they switched days.
They skipped a day.
Yeah.
They decided that today it went from Friday to Sunday.
Sunday. Yeah.
And they essentially skipped Shabbat that week and then rescheduled the rest of their lives, essentially,
right.
Basically.
Because they want to be on the same time. They were doing most of their business with America, and now they're doing most of their business with Australia, New Zealand, and
right.
Japan,
so
and they want to be on the same
thing. But it's a massive obvious issue. Like,
right.
How does that work?
Right. It's another interesting topic.
That means that Shabbos is Sunday, and I don't.
That's another shia.
Became Christian.
but American Samoa, which is very close, almost swimming distance, still stays on the American side of the dateline.
So you could have, I don't know, you could just avoid Shabbos.
Right, so you go for a swim and you miss that.
Anyway, so.
You're
literally like on one side of the boy, and then go over, and you like skip Shabbos.
Right. A bit like Purim, you can do that.
A bit like Purim.
You can stand on one side just outside Yerushalayim and then just jump
yeah,
over into and miss the other way around and miss Purim altogether, or have two Purims. So Shabbat has Kedusha regardless. God gives the Kedusha to Shabbat. All of the festivals and Rosh Chodesh, we say in the davening, Mikadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim. And the Gemara in Brachot says, right, in source 1, Mikadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim, Yisrael D'Kadshin Hulizmanim, right, and Mikadesh Yisrael Roshay Chadashim, Yisrael, the Mikadshinu, the Roshay Chadashim. That the blessing we say is who sanctifies Israel and the times, because it is Israel who sanctifies the times of the festivals and the times of Rosh Chodesh. So, in other words, God decides the date of Shabbat, the Sanhedrin, or Hillel, when he fixed the calendar, decides the dates of all the festivals and Roshay Chodesh. But who is it who decides the date of Purim? It was Haman. Right? Who did his lottery and defined the date of Purim. Which is interesting. We say that, sorry.
No, it's just that it's ironic, because it falls on the 15th of the month.
14th. 15th in Yerushalayim, yeah.
Okay. But it's like, just about everything is either the 1st or the 15th. I mean, nothing
right.
falls.
Any other
nothing falls.
Except for Shavuot, which doesn't really have a date anyway.
Right. It's just like you can always look at the moon and know full moon, run holiday, new moon, run holiday.
Right.
There's no 19th of the month. I mean, like,
but it's
there's
the
a couple of fast days. But other than that, you don't have.
Right.
So it's ironic that it would still fall on us because you assume they're not using Jewish calendars. So it's.
Well, they, according to the Megillah,
like
they were.
It rolled along through, which it did a month ago, and which it will do in a month as long, 3 months.
But they were using, like...
In the Megillah, it says Adar, Chodesh Shtei Masrei, and it says Chodesh Tevet, when it goes to the king. It does, the authors of the Megillah use the, I was going to say the Jewish names, but the Babylonian names anyway. So, and I assume the Babylonians used a lunar calendar as well, so I don't know
okay.
which calendar he was using, but it, anyway, but it's Haman who chose this
okay.
date. Or not even him, it's his lottery that chose this date. And the holiness of Purim is even greater. The holiness of Purim, which was like, Shabbat was chosen by God, that's pretty cool. The festival was chosen by us, that's pretty neat. But Haman, who chose that one, his festival got even more holiness. We know the statement of the Arizal that Yom HaKippurim is a day like Purim. But really, Purim is better and Yom Kippur is an imitation of that. there's a Gemara in Megillah which says that Haman's decree did more in terms of getting the Jews to do Teshuvah. Haman's decree did more than the 48 prophets and the seven prophetesses. Someone just told me at Marav while we're waiting for the minyan that the 48 prophets refers to the 48 Shari Kedusha, the 48 levels of Kedusha. The seven prophetesses are the seven sefirot, which really ultimately come down to Malchut, which is one which is the 49th level. And Haman was one higher than that. He was the 50th level, which is something we can't normally attain at all, but he achieved greater than that. So Purim is in a sense, the holiest of all days. There's a statement that says that all the other festivals will be nullified, and Purim will never be nullified. Purim somehow has a greater level of Kedusha in some ways than all of the other festivals, even though it has none of the restrictions of the other festivals, and it does have its own mitzvahs, but nothing that seems as holy as all the other ones. Now, it's ironic that Haman is the one who chooses the day for the festival that commemorates the destruction of Haman and Amalek. We remember Parshat Zachor and destroying Amalek. It's ironic, but that's an irony which we find throughout history, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin says. It gives two examples. Amar Ephraim Maksha'ah, Talmidosh Rabbi Meir, Mishim Rabbi Meir, so Ephraim Maksha'ah to the name of Rabbi Meir. Avadia Ger Adami Hayas. Avadia the prophet was a convert from the Edomite people. Vayinu Damri Inshi, and then he prophesies. The whole book of Avadia is one chapter, which is all prophesying about the downfall of Edom. So, Hayinu Damri Inshi, so he quotes this folk saying, which is, Mine Ubei Abba Nezel Bei Naga. From the very forest is where the handle of the axe comes that chops down the forest. In other words, the forest provides for its own destruction. So too, Edom provides for its own prophecies of its own destruction through Avadia. And we have the same thing with Moab as well. It says, Vayach et Moab v'yimdadim b'chevel ha-shkevotam arta, that he, David HaMelech, smote Moab and measured them out with a string and laid them on the ground. Am Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shum ben Yochai, and Rabbi Inshi, Mine obey abe lezel abe naga, that the handle of the axe comes from the forest itself. So David HaMelech, who is a descendant of Moab, of root HaMoabiyah, is the one who destroys Moab. And the same way, Haman, who is from Amalek, is the one who destroys Amalek through his, both in the time of Purim, when that was the fifth, when that was the time when the Jews could destroy Amalek, and also through all of history, Purim is the time when we celebrate the downfall of Amalek. And that was chosen by Haman. Now the interesting thing, I suppose, one of the many, many interesting things about Esther is that it's written in Hebrew. Because all of the other books that were written at that time, Daniel and Ezra and Nehemiah, are written basically in Aramaic, which is the language that they were speaking at the time. Esther is written in Hebrew, which is odd, being that it's written in Galus. Except for the name of the festival itself, Purim, which is a Persian word and not a Hebrew word. And the Megillah has to translate that for us to say, Pur Hua Goral, that the Pur is the lottery, because we didn't know what the name, I mean, we may not have known what it was otherwise. So Rav Tzadok says that the people chose to call it Purim. It wasn't a rabbinic decision called Purim. People were already calling it Purim because before the festival was established as a festival, and they were calling it by the Persian name to show that it was the Persian concept of a Pur as opposed to the Jewish concept of a goral, of a lottery. Right. What does that mean? Source number three. Haman says, B'chodesh HaRishon, B'chodesh Nisan, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan. This is the first time also that the names of the months are mentioned. That the months that we have now don't appear in Tanakh apart from Megillat Esther. Right? There are different names given to them by Shlomo Melech. We have a couple of those. The Torah only calls in the first month, and the second month, and the third month. The names, which makes sense because they were Babylonian names, and we didn't have them until we went to Babylonian exile. But if I'm not mistaken, Megillat Esther is the first time that they appear. So the Chodesh Rishon, and that's why the Megillah has to tell you, the first month, Ooh, Chodesh Nisan. Since you've never heard of what it is, you used to call it the first month, what it is also Nisan. Bishnat Shtei Mesrei Lemelech HaChashverosh, in the 12th year of the king of Chashverosh, whoever he may be. He appealed Tor, Haman cast lots, Hua Goral, that means lottery, because you don't speak Persian. Lifnei Haman, Miyom Liyom, Asayisha Chodesh, Nei Masahu, Chodesh Adar. From day to day, month to month, it's the 12th month, which is Adar. Again, the translation of the 12th month is Adar. And Haman sees that as very significant. Haman does not see that as random at all. He says, right, Tana was taught in the Megillah, it says it was taught, Kevin Shnafal Pur B'Chodesh Adar, when the lottery, which he intended, he didn't even touch the, he got other people to do it all in front of him so that he wouldn't influence the outcome in any way, and he wanted to have, to see it as some kind of divine portent. So when it fell out in the month of Adar, Samach Simcha Gedola, he was very, very happy. Amar, he said, Nafali Pur B'Yerch Shemet B'Moshe. I've got them now, because this is the month when Moshe dies, so I'll be able to get the Jews in the month of Adar, which is odd, but okay. What's even odder is that he only read the first half of the book. He didn't know that Moshe not only died on the 7th of Adar, but also was born on the 7th of Adar. So I thought the end of the Jews was the beginning of the Jews. And it's a brand new beginning for the Jewish people. At first, when the lottery happens, Haman seems to see significance in the lottery. He's using a random system to understand the divine will. He's not seeing it as random, he's seeing it as meaningful. And that's really the right, that's the correct approach. Right? Because the Pasuk in Mishlei says that b'chek yutal et hakaral, they cast a lot, and this is not my translation, they cast a lot in the lap, and the mishpat, the result of that is from God. Whereas the lottery doesn't come out randomly, it comes out with the will of God. So Haman originally thinks what he's got is divine approval for his massacre of the Jewish people, and he's got the date picked with divine approval, and yet, really, it turns out that both Haman and his progenitor Amalek symbolize the opposite view in the world. In other words, their claim is that there is no meaning in the world, that everything is random. There is no purpose to the world. We read Zachor Pas Shabbat, that Amalek came and it says, remember what Amalek did to you, Asher Korcha B'derech, that he, so Korcha has at least three different meanings in the Gemara, one of which is he came B'mikra, he happened upon you, he just randomly bumped into you on the way out of Egypt to Israel. Now clearly it was not a random, Amalek had to come from somewhere else, especially to find the Jews and attack them, and it was pre-planned. But the meaning is that Amalek, by definition, Amalek shows the randomness and the purposelessness of the world. As does Haman, right? When Haman comes and tells his wife that the Megillah, like the story of the Megillah, only finishes halfway through, and Haman's dead by like chapter 7, and then we just keep going. And that's also interesting. Anyway, when Haman's story is nearly finished, he comes and tells his wife, Haman Lazarus Ishto, Holochola Avav, he said to his wife and all his close friends, Et Kolasher Karahu, everything that happened to him, everything that had befallen him, in that translation. Right. And again, the word Karahu sounds like randomness, right? The Mikra. This happened and that happened and none of it has a plan, it all just happened. Ve'amru lo chachamav v'der shishto im mizir ha-yehudim l'rachai asher chilot v'lipol lefanav lo yitruchalo ki nafol tipol lefanav. And then they all turn on him and they say, well, if you're attacking Mordechai, who's a Jew, then you've got no chance because you're in big trouble. But at the end of the story, Haman starts off the story thinking that God has given him approval through the lottery, and it's not random. And he ends up the story by saying it's all just bad luck, and it all just happened randomly. And that's And that's often the way we find that people who think they're acting with the best of intentions, or they think they're acting in one way, they don't pay attention to their real motives, which are more buried more deeply, where they can be honest with themselves and see that. And at the end of the story, they see, looking back, that what their true essence is. Like Bilam starts off pretending and thinking, he really thinks and believes that he's a tremendously great prophet, and he's there's a sick kid, that's not good.
And husband at home. Hi. I went to my shiur. Do you need me to come home? What's wrong? Keep going. Okay, head out.
So Bilam starts off thinking that he is a great prophet and that he's got the power to curse the Jewish people and that he's really holy. And at the end, he shows that he, with his advice to commit adultery with non-Moab and with his prophecy, he shows that at the end he realizes who he really is. A different but similar idea we find with when Abraham sends Eliezer to find a wife for Yitzhak. Sends him off to Haran, and when he gets to really speaking to Lavan and Rivka, there he says that if you look in the Rashi there, he says really he was hoping that Abraham would marry Yitzhak off to his daughter. That he had a daughter, and he was right, and yeah. I guess from the word love over there, is that right? I can't remember. He says over there an idea which really, but why did he not? It's almost exactly the same conversation he actually had with Abraham. He's telling the same conversation over again to Lavan. And the second time is when he admits this underlying ulterior motive that he really was hoping it wouldn't work. The first time he didn't know this was, he thought he was acting entirely one way. And then only afterwards, with hindsight, at the end of the story, he realizes that there were other reasons as well. Same thing with Haman. He thought from the beginning that he was doing this with there was meaning to it, there was a purpose to what he was doing, this was divinely mandated. At the end of his story, he realizes that it was all, that he's been acting in a way that's random and the world is random. Everything okay? Yes, we go?
No. Because that wasn't even head after I was touching. That was very odd. You know how long it took me to realize that this is not my oldest child? But,
at least you've got girls. You don't have to get confused in the boys and the girls. That's more embarrassing.
What?
When I can't tell if it's a boy or a girl, one of my sons or daughters on CP.
I'm like talking to her, I'm like, okay, head after, take a deep breath. And then she said something, and I'm like, I'm not talking to her.
She's scared? Like, what's she saying?
She's really sick. She's sick. Mm. She's really sick. But the thing I was
is that your thing?
Yes, my fault.
Yes. I thought that... You thought she'd stay asleep all night?
I thought she'd, because she took the drugs, that she would just go out. So it's only alcohol, it's not any magical potion. Sorry, I can't get you right. Sorry.
Your foot, Shlema.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And you'll go in a few minutes, so I'll just try and finish quickly, I think. So, at the end, Haman realizes that it's random. Now, this is Rav Tzadok's brilliance. He says that, why does Haman perceive the world as random if it's not really, we know that it's not really random. We know that there's a plan and a purpose, and God has runs the world. So how does Haman perceive it as that? So Rav Tzadok says that the way a person perceives the world is the way that a person perceives God is the way God acts with them.
Right.
And the example, the classic example of that is the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Mishnah in the end of Sanhedrin, in the last chapter, says that anyone who denies Tchiyat HaMetim, anyone who does not believe in Tchiyat HaMetim, does not have a portion in the world to come. In other words, in the world to come here means Tchiyat HaMetim in the context of this Mishnah.
Right.
The Gemara says, why does somebody who doesn't believe in Tchiyat HaMetim not have a portion in the world to come? And the Gemara says, right, so The kokachlama, why is it such a severe punishment to the person who missed the alam abad just because he had the wrong hashkafic view? Because he didn't believe in it, that's why he doesn't get a share. Because the way God acts with the world is the way people act with him. And it brings the example of the shalish, of the courtier, the advisor, in the time of Elisha. There's a Sancherib is besieging Yerushalayim, and everyone is starving, and Elisha comes and prophesies that this time tomorrow the food's going to be available very, very cheaply, even though now they're starving and there's no food at all. And the shalish, the minister who's standing there, doesn't believe Elisha. Elisha turns to him and says, you'll see it, but you're not going to be able to enjoy it. And then, and this is the half Torah, I think, Parsha Mitzorah. Then the army that's surrounding them gets scared and runs away and leave all their food behind. So everyone goes running out to get all the food from the surrounding camp. And this chap, the civil servant who was standing there, gets trampled by everybody and dies and doesn't get to see it. And the reason is because he didn't believe in it, therefore he didn't get to enjoy it. So that the way a person works with what relates to God is the way that God relates to them. And Rav Tzadok says, since Haman's essence was seeing the randomness in the world, therefore God acted with him in a way that was random. Because he does that, that God accepts that's also an illusion. We talked two weeks ago, about the difference, I wasn't sure 2 weeks ago, whatever, anyway, the difference between the world of Bechira for Rav Tzadok and the world of Yetzirah. Without going through all that again, the world in which we live, where we think we live in a world where we have free choice, where we can see things happening and not see God clearly, and there's a world of Yediyah where everything is how God understands the world. There's two different perspectives on the world. The reality in the world of Bechira, we say that because I don't believe in it, therefore I'd miss out on it. But in the reality, from God's perspective, it's because this person has no share in the world to come, that's why they can't believe in the world to come. Because this person doesn't believe Elisha's prophecy, that's why they won't get to see Elisha's prophecy. Because Haman, his essence is randomness, that's why he sees God as random. So from our perspective, I think I'm deciding this, whatever it is. Rav Tzadok says that the essence of that person, they're not going to have a world, because they don't have a share in the world to come, that's why they can't believe in the world to come. They can't connect to it, because from that perspective, it's not there. And that's why, therefore, since Amalek's essence is randomness, since Amalek is all about Mikra, therefore that's how he perceives the world. It's not a punishment that because he's right, that's the essence of who he is. And that's what Haman realizes at the end of his story, that everything is random, that there is no plan and there's no divine mandate for what he's doing, and he's messed everything up. And then it's just, well, good night.
Change it.
Can you change your essence?
Yeah, if people don't believe in the world's
coming, it's because they're not
got
a
share, and they're like, you know, since we've done
the Shiva,
or even if whatever,
and then
they're like, okay, do you believe?
Is it
because now there's a game?
Yeah, it could be. It could be a
person's
reflective
of like. Yes.
I don't
know. I mean,
not everything you believe in is necessarily going, you know, people believe in unicorns and rainbows and pots of gold. Not necessarily, but the question of whether a person can change their essence or not is an interesting one, which Rav Tzadok speaks about at length. I think not everyone who... If we have someone today who doesn't believe in the world to come, that doesn't necessarily mean they've thought about it and don't believe in it. It just means they've got other things that are more interesting.
But you ask the question on the street by
right. So it doesn't mean that, but somehow profoundly, someone who can't believe in the world to come is because they have no portion. Can they change that? Rav Tzadok would say yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can take it like even on a not so deep level and just be like, let's say, I don't know, you can control your perceptions of things. It's not this isn't necessarily perception, but like if you wanna like you're saying how you relate to Hashem is how Hashem relates to you. So let's take Chesed for example. If you were to like notice things in the world a lot more, you would feel them a lot more.
Right.
If you can notice like Chesed and whatever that being done, then you would feel like more being done to you. Just I think it's also an appreciation thing. I think maybe this is slightly more like literal, but you, I mean...
Right, it's also true. I definitely agree with that. But the reality is that Haman's lottery was meaningful, just not for what he meant it to be.
Right.
He thought it was divine mandate for his plan, but God was working with him in a way that's random, so he didn't got the opposite of that. Right. It was meaningful as the date to destroy Amalek, to destroy Haman and his team. And
what was the plan?
Whose plan?
Haman's plan, right?
Kill the Jewish people.
Yeah, I got that. But I mean, was he literally just like going to round them up and chop their heads off?
I think so.
In one day?
I think so.
How?
He got a year to get ready for it.
He was just building an army for ages and ages and ages,
but
no one else.
I guess so. That's what the story says.
It's just a bit weird.
Yes, but it's easier to believe in that now after the Holocaust and all
right.
That. The numbers, it's whatever. Yes.
Yeah.
And the flip side is, how did the Jews manage to do the inverse of that?
Right.
In one day.
In one day.
Although they also had a few months to get ready for it.
I mean, they knew it was coming, so...
They knew it was coming, and Haman was killed on the second day of Pesach.
And then
in Iyar, I think, is when Ahasuerus sent a letter saying the Jews had to defend themselves. They also had 9 months to get ready to defend themselves. So it wasn't in one day they had to stockpile and whatever.
It's interesting that they still, even after Haman was dead, neo-Nazis are like a great example, but neo-Nazis don't have the kind of power that we're talking about in here. You know, there's still people who wanted to go out and kill the Jews even afterwards.
Right. Except that you could easily see that Haman fell down because of a petty feud with Mordechai. But not necessarily.
You think that would rupture his whole...
And the queen is now Jewish.
Right, exactly. You would think that all that would kind of...
Right.
Dissipate the hatred a little bit.
Right.
Or maybe increase it. Maybe it would do the opposite.
Because Jews control the world.
Yeah, we do.
Yep. I don't know how much time I've got. I don't want to. Okay, one more minute. Something. profoundly, lottery does show God's hand in the world, and that there are two separate mitzvot and one wonderful story from the Gemara, which shows that we do use lottery. Plus a story from Tzadik in our time, which you absolutely have to read if you haven't read it. The land of Israel was divided up into 12 tribes. They sent out cartographers to make maps and to make 12 chunks of land, but they distributed those 12 chunks using a lottery. As the Torah says, right, Ach begaral yechalek et aretz v'shemot matot avotam yinchalu, that the lottery will be used to divide up the land. And that was seen as God apportioning the land to each tribe got what they were supposed to have. And furthermore, the Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about Achan and Yeshua, this conversation, right, in the Battle of Ai. The Jews came before the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down, etc. And then they went to fight the Battle of Ai, and they lost. And that was quite upsetting for them, because they weren't expecting to lose any battles. And God said the reason they lost was because when they destroyed Jericho, Yeshua said, no one may take anything from here. And God says, the reason they lost this battle is because someone took some of the spoils of there, and therefore we've lost the Yeshua. He says, well, tell me who it was, and I'll go deal with them. God said, I don't say Lashon Hara. I'm not going to tell you. But do a lottery, and you'll find out that way. So they did a lottery, and they went from each tribe, and then each family, and they came down on Achan, because he was the criminal. So Achan turned around to Yeshua and says, well, you can't find me guilty based on a lottery. I mean, if Yeshua and Eliezer and Elazar, Kohen Gadol, the two of you, if I would cast a lot through the two of you, one of you would be guilty as well. You can't, lottery is a meaningless thing. Yeshua says, don't mess with lottery, because that's how we're going to divide up the land. And if you start messing with that, then you've undone everything, because lottery really is God's will. And then therefore he says, please confess so that everyone else will see that this is God's will as well, even though I know it's true, and he did, and they will live happily ever after, except for Achan, who was killed. So we see that it does show the will of God. And the Kohen Gadol, Yom Kippur, right, the distinction between life and death, between the, they both died, but anyway, two goats, one for Azazel and one for Lashem, that was decided by a lottery. There were two metal plates, and the Kohen Gadol picked them out. and one was final as the other. And the whole time, the Gemara in Yuma says that as long as Shimon HaTzadik was alive, it would always work out that the Lashem, the goat, the goat for God would always be on the right hand side, and the goat for Israel would be on the left hand side. And that would show God, God's pleasure with the Jewish people. And there was also a crimson thread that would hang, that would always turn white. And different miracles that happened, as long as the people were doing the right thing, then God was acting with them in a way that showed this lottery was not random at all, but was run by God. And then after Shimon and Tzadik died, then some years would be this way and some years would be the other way. It was a random way, but it was all, equally much with God
right.
controlling the world and showing he's happy or not happy with the way the world works.
So how would that work now? I mean, like, what it's like... Are we allowed to decide things by
tipping
coins and stuff like that?
That's why you've got to read a tzaddik in our time. There's a story there which is so famous that you must have known it, but you should read it anyway, about the Lamed Hay. Just in the War of Independence 1948, they were trying to liberate Gush Etzion, and
yeah.
they sent 35 men there who all got killed, and the bodies were all buried in one grave, and in 1967 they got back to the...
Oh, yeah.
And they tried, and they couldn't identify 12 of the bodies, and... they came to Arya Levine and asked him to use a goral to identify the bodies, which he did, and it's all written up there, all the clues and things. So yes, there are times that we can use the lottery to...
But that's a bit of a different scale than deciding.
I mean, I think that we are supposed to act as if we have, as if we can choose between right and wrong, and not live our lives based on rolling dice.
But what if it is something that is, like, let's say, something you don't have an idea about, like, whether the impact is, like, what do I eat for lunch, or whether the impact is, like, do I leave this country, or whatever it is, you know, like...
If, in theory, I think...
If you've got the right focus in your mind, that, like, these dice aren't the power, that, like, it's coming from somewhere else, are we allowed to? Is that, like, kind of giving ourselves the power of the vote, almost, like...
Yeah, I think
so. We're allowed to do it?
I think it can be. I think that you're supposed to try and make a decision using your rational faculties. If there's some decision that you really cannot make because there's no way of doing it, then I think you can act on. Usually what you do is you flip the coin and then it comes out with the wrong answer and you realise what you really wanted
right.
it. And
no, so I'm saying, if it's a completely neutral thing, where you honestly like whatever happens doesn't matter, like, that is the reason you're flipping the coin, because you really don't mind which way it lands, and that's okay.
Isn't there a book called The Dice Man, wasn't there, in the 60s or 70s, about a person who lived his life like this?
Oh.
Anyway, I'm not passing halakha. I think that, yes, there could be a time, if you really got to a state where it's impossible to decide, then you can give a decision back to God to make.
Right. Does that mean that Haman did choose
the
date then, or God did?
Well, God did choose the date, and it was the right date.
Right.
Haman chose it, and God gave it the Kedusha
right.
to be exactly what it wanted to be. Which, very quickly, one last line is... One last line is that this does not mean that when something... I think I said this every single week, so I'll say it again. This does not mean that if something happens, you say, oh, yes, God's punishing that person over there because they're not doing the right thing, and that's because of that, and that's because of that. It's not supposed to be me understanding God's... how God runs the world. I mean, all sorts of idiotic things published on the internet in the last... Well, every week there's idiotic things published on the internet, but in the last week people have been saying even more idiotic things. Rabbis and who should know better, saying idiotic things like God thinks this and God does that. We don't know how God... Our job is not to know how God works or how God runs the show. And we're not supposed to say nothing is random and therefore that happened to that person because they did that sin. What I am supposed to know is to look at that and understand that God is trying to teach me a message from everything I see in the world and everything that happens, and what can I do to improve myself and make the world a better place. It's about me, and it's not about pointing the finger at other people and saying it's all their fault. But if we understand that God does run the world, God does run the world. To what extent he micromanages is a machlokes between chassidus and nagdus, I think. But I'm going to leave it there. Stop here. The end.
Thank you
very much. It's not really